You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Pauline Kael on the occasion of the publication by Dutton of her mammoth anthology For Keeps, 30 Years at the Movies. And this is an interview that we're doing by telephone simply because there's no way that Pauline Kael would be in California right now, and there's no way that I would let this book come out without talking to her. I wanted to begin by saying that for me, reading For Keeps is not to find out about the movies you reviewed for 30 years. I read it the way I read a collection by Edmund Wilson or James Agee, to see the characteristic tones of excitement, contempt, enjoyment, thrill that were there at the time. The publishers of books like this like to pretend that they're service for people checking out things to play on the VCR. But for me, it's the writing that keeps these books alive. What do you feel?
Well, I hope that that's true, but I also hope that in the course of writing, I illuminate something about the movies of the past few decades, because it was a great period in movies, like the New Wave in France, which came and went very quickly. Ours lasted a little bit longer, but not much longer. And I think people need to be reminded of that. But of course, I've picked these pieces also in terms of what I thought showed off the personality of the critic. I've picked some things that I was jumped on for at the time and will probably be jumped on for again, but that I felt I really showed myself in true colors.
Well, the first piece in the book, which is a review of HUD, is not your first actual piece, but the one in which you talk about your childhood, your father. You kind of give the lie to the movies there by announcing that although your dad was an adulterer, he was still a good and respected guy in the town. And it seemed like the most kind of forward appearance on the in the criticism scene. Still, the essay reads like pure shock.
Well, I put it at the beginning so that nobody could say I was trying to slip in. And for another thing, it's a very unpopular view of rape that I take in that movie, very different from the one that the other critics took. And I wanted to get that off my chest right at the start so people wouldn't come upon it later and say, but wait a minute.
It's funny because in that particular instance, you talk about a rape as being a situation in which the man and woman will probably be celebrating this particular aggression annually. And it's still, of course, a shock to read. Do you mind explaining?
Well, HUD rapes Alma, the woman he's crazy about, and she's crazy about him because it's the only way he can connect with her, and he's drunk, and he's quite brutal about it. The rape, however, is interrupted by his rather mealy-minded young nephew. and the movie people at the time took it as a victory for goodness and virtue, but it seemed to me it probably destroyed the lives of the two characters because Alma then felt forced to leave the farm.
Whereas if it hadn't been interrupted?
If it hadn't been interrupted, they might have stayed together. I mean, he would have been guilty in the morning and probably brought her flowers, and she would have felt a little absurd about having fought him so hard, but pleased that it went off. It would have been more like Gone with the Wind, where a rape turns out rather successfully, except that he doesn't realize it has.
I remember once we were together in San Francisco. You were about to talk with Jean-Luc Godard publicly on stage, and you told me that it would be difficult. I said that it would be easy because he was a poet and he would say anything. And you said, no, that you're very practical-minded and you would have to keep him within the realms of possibility. And it's always been that practical-mindedness, as in that comment about the rape, that seemed to be the most interesting thing. What would you call it? Sensibleness? Where did you develop it?
Horse sense. Maybe coming from a farm. William Shawn, the editor of the New Yorker, always preferred to think that I'd made that up. He refused to believe I came from a farm.
Well, it never seems to a reader as if you came from a farm. I, of course, before I ever knew that a movie critic had a name, read you in The New Yorker, and I think I read your very first pieces for The New Yorker, the piece on Bonnie and Clyde, and there you demonstrate the history of this couple throughout movies. They live by night, the others as well. You always talked as someone who had been alive and knew of the arts forever.
I think I did. I mean, farm people are not kept out of libraries or kept away from theaters or kept away from stage shows or music. We had a lot going on in our house.
But, for instance, you've been able to say in ways that, you know, constantly chasing me. Just last week, after an initial gush of overenthusiasm for Natural Born Killers, I went back to see the film, didn't respond to it, happened to read your essay on movie brutalists, and read a comment that you made. You said that a lot of young people responding to a film will respond to something that the filmmaker has just tossed in, happened to be something he was reading at the time, and it happens to be something alive in the culture at the moment. It's something that the youthful mind will glom onto, but not really at the heart of the movie, and that you have to see past the flourishes to see to the heart of a film. At the time when I first read that, I thought, no, no, no! Jean-Luc Godard is really saying something about Bouvard and Pécuchet.
Although I can't figure out what. But Oliver Stone is the culmination of that. He throws in everything. And Natural Born Killers is, in a way, the masterpiece of his nothingness.
But had you spent, well, I know you did, time around a lot of writers and filmmakers, were they part of your college years?
Not filmmakers, because I was at Berkeley and there was no film program there. I mean, we talked a lot about making movies, and later I met movie makers, but it wasn't as if I grew up in the L.A. area. I grew up in Northern California. But we talked. We went to movies and argued about them, and we talked a lot. My friends Robert Horan and Robert Duncan were both poets, but we were intensely interested in movies. We would sometimes sit up half the night arguing about a movie. It was actually Duncan who talked me into writing my first movie review.
Had you tried other kinds of writing first?
Well, I tried some a little later, and I tried playwriting, and I think I wasn't bad at it, but there was no way to get anything done in my circumstances. And I worked with some filmmakers. I worked with James Broughton and some others making movies. But the minute I tried criticism, everything seemed to fall into place. I think I'm a natural-born critic, at least of movies. But I think maybe I would have been of books, too. But I loved it when I did it. It came very easy to me. I never have understood people who found it an ordeal to sit down and write a movie review, because I loved the process of the way all the associations you make in your mind come into play in the course of a review, the way you discover connections in the movie itself and the way the movie connects to your life that you weren't fully conscious of at the start.
What finally brought you to New York?
Well, I had been to New York on a trip. What finally brought me in 65 when I moved there was I couldn't make a living on the West Coast. I'd published pieces in Partisan Review and other magazines, but I just couldn't make a living. I had offers from Eastern magazines. It was tougher than I thought. Freelancing was hell. Because I was supporting a child as well as two animals and had a rather complicated domestic situation. So it wasn't easy as a freelance writer. And the first magazine I wrote for regularly, they dumped me after 5 issues. That was Life magazine. But I had the fun in those 5 issues of writing about Bernardo Bertolucci's Before the Revolution and Francesco Rosi's Moment of Truth, and some other good movies that they probably wouldn't ordinarily have covered.
Was there an immediate response to you as a writer from the West Coast?
Negative. Easterners are not crazy about having a Western critic who's been writing for places like Film Quarterly turn up on their doorsteps. They took my writing as Western instead of as my writing, because other Westerners didn't write the same way about movies, but they took it as some sort of invasion.
Now, it's my impression, I could be quite wrong, that you're the first person to write about movies at this length in quite this way. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't think so, but I don't think I should be the one to say it.
No, but it seems to me that you invented the movie essay.
Well, there had been some wonderful movie critics, but I think I perhaps linked it to personal experience more, and I was certainly attacked for that more. People didn't understand why I was doing it. I was doing it as a way of being truthful to how movies affected us. Not that I wanted to exploit my domestic life.
But I think, for instance, you know, A.G. from time to time in spirits of disgruntledness would review 10 movies at a time, you know, dismissing them with a line. I look to people who have published volumes of Otis Ferguson, and of course there's the great Manny Farber, but no one had really... The Bonnie and Clyde essay, when it appeared, is that the first in The New Yorker?
Movies on Television was actually the first. It was a few months before Bonnie and Clyde.
It broke things up. I mean, it seemed that suddenly someone
It broke things up for me. I was writing for The New Republic, and they refused to print both of those. That's how they landed in The New Yorker.
How did they... What did The New Yorker do on taking you? How did that happen?
Well, Sean was a great editor in terms of immediate, decisive responsiveness. I phoned him when Movies on Television had been refused by The New Republic, and he sent a messenger for it and called me within 2 hours and said, I'm taking it. And he did something similar with Bonnie and Clyde.
When you were writing the Bonnie and Clyde, when I read it, the thrill of reading your writing was always, for me, the thrill of a writer who has not edited discovery out of the prose itself, so that there's nothing glacéd or embalmed or glacial or eroded. It seems to arrive, you know, steaming. When you wrote Bonnie and Clyde, did you know that something had, you know, broken through?
No, I knew I was having a great time writing about it, and I knew that the movie was something new. It had been so widely panned, it had to be. It had been miserably treated. A number of the movies that are now accepted as classics had been hideously reviewed. I mean, that was true of McCabe and Mrs. Miller and a lot of the movies I loved, Mean Streets, Taxi Driver. They all got virulent pans in the press.
By the way, I'm talking to Pauline Kael upon the publication of her anthology For Keeps, 30 Years at the Movies, published by Dutton. There was, it seems to me, perhaps still is, massive retaliation by New York intellectuals for someone taking the movies this seriously, at this length, and writing with such immediacy and dexterity.
Don't you think that's because their students loved movies and wanted to talk about them? And most of these people were professors. So that at one point when Kazin took a punch at me in print, I thought, he doesn't really mean that against me. He means it because his students want to talk about movies and he hasn't bothered going to see them.
But don't you think in part that that history, almost ritual of abuse, I think of Renata Adler and others, seems almost in part a response to your facility?
Well, I think also, I think it may be also that she represented the kind of elegant New Yorker prose that I violated. I talked about that earlier in the year in an interview I gave that was printed in the New Yorker about the kind of moneyed smoothness of the prose that was a New Yorker feature. And I think people who wrote that very smooth, elegant prose were offended by my abrupt writing. And I think her attack on me in the New York Review of Books was largely an attack on the freedom of my style. It offended her.
Well, I think also part of the attacks has been the subject matter. People always found it easy to, say, admire last year at Marion Bod or a film by Robert Bresson, but to write with enthusiasm about American movie making and to write about it as an art form, even if a frequently botched and prostituted one and full of crazy, unpredictable corners, seemed, you know, that was the generation of the work of art. And not only was it the work of art, it was formally consistent and one had to determine what it meant. The last thing you did was respond to it.
Well, I certainly did get punched a lot in the New York Times and other places for liking Bob and Ted and Carol and Alice in movies like that. I really love American movies, or did then. Lately, there haven't been too many to love. But that did offend New Yorker readers, and particularly New Yorker writers. But, you know, it had some advantages for me. After Renata Adler's attack, I was no longer asked to do college commencement speeches. And so I saved a lot of energy.
Did, you know, you wrote up until a few years ago, and in that interview in The New Yorker, in a special issue on the movies, you very quickly cleared away a lot of critical detritus around The Piano and other movies as well. Do you still itch to write?
Oh, sure. It's just I feel I can't really do it justice now. I'm not strong enough. I'm really in terrible physical shape. The only part of me that works is half of my brain. And no, I love still to see movies and to talk about them. And if I could, I would write about them. I just don't feel I could do the job the right way. And I wouldn't want to do it half-assed.
Is there anything that you would, you know, because the thrill was to see in The New Yorker the review of a movie that Pauline Kael told me I had to see. I have to confess that in recent years, I've come to think that I was never a film junkie. I was a Pauline Kael junkie, and I had to see the things that Kael was responding to. And now, to a certain extent, you know, people will tell me about a small film, but without the vigor of presentation and, I don't know, the ultimacy of those reviews, I frequently will let it slide by. Is there anything that I'm missing right now?
I don't think you're missing much. There are small pictures like One False Move, which I hope you caught.
I did.
And good movies like that. But major movies, movies that affect our consciousness of ourselves, like Bonnie and Clyde. There haven't been too many lately. And, of course, you get fooled if you trust the press because practically everything now is touted and it becomes an embarrassment picking up the theater pages of the paper. I did get a lot of mail after that interview in March from people who said they missed having somebody tell them what they absolutely had to see. And I feel bad about the fact that it isn't clear in the press now. I think there are some pretty good critics, but their voices aren't raised when something extraordinary comes along. They tend to be rather soft on movies, and so people get fooled time after time. But, of course, remember that people were often offended when they went to see the movies that I recommended. So that didn't really work for them either. Now they tend to glamorize that period and to think that I sent them to all the goodies. At the time, I got a lot of angry mail from people who hated what I sent them to.
Now, if a young writer were starting to write criticism now, do you think
he'd be a fool to pick movies as his subject? The field is overcrowded, and it's not a great period for movies. He'd be much smarter to deal with television or books.
It seems to me that one of the things that kept your writing alive, and I don't think, to my mind, it didn't waver. My objection to that Renata Adler essay back then was that, are you crazy? I read her because of her excesses. It's why we read Faulkner. It's why we read any writer we care about. The excess is the fingerprint. And it's, you know, the...
It's also the daring, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Because a writer who's excessive knows it and says, the hell with it, this is how I feel, I'm going to say it now. I may regret it in the morning, but I'll live through it.
Are there regrets?
I've never regretted praise of anything. What I've regretted are movies that I didn't realize people would take so seriously that I should have given more analysis to. And I regret now certain movies that I think are real stinkers that I'd like to write about to explain why I think they're so bad. But no, it's like, you know, if you're out somewhere and you see something beautiful and want to buy it but can't afford it and don't, that's the thing you regret, not the extravagance you committed. And I live with my extravagances pretty easily.
Well, let's indulge one. Do you really think that Schindler should have been a swindler?
Oh, sure. I mean, he needed to be the hero of a sick joke. I mean, it's a really extravagantly insane story. The fact that it happens to be true makes it more so. I think Spielberg simply isn't the man to understand the material fully because he isn't worldly enough. Schindler, above all, was worldly. And Spielberg just doesn't have that in him. There's a streak of American naivete about him when he deals with a subject like that.
So he sentimentalized it?
Worse, he didn't give personality to the people. We needed the contrast between this German gambler and con man and the Jews. The Jews were made mice, unfortunately.
Not the first time.
No, not the first time. I'm not crazy about mouse as a conception either. I think it works as a piece of writing and as a piece of drawing, but it doesn't work as a conception for me.
The Art Spiegelman book. Now, I'm curious because, you know, I think of Shoah as well. That's a vexed subject. Has there been a piece that has dealt with that kind of oppression unsentimentally and toughly?
There have been some very good documentaries. I don't regard show as primarily a documentary. It's too gussied up with art. But it's a very, very tough subject. Some subjects really defeat their makers. I mean, Spielberg was very courageous in his attempt. He just didn't quite have the talents to bring it off. I think his talents come out to their fullest, and I don't mean this disparagingly, in movies like Jaws. and E.T. and Close Encounters. There's something rather thrilling about him when he really expresses his personality fully. And there's something held back and cool about Schindler's List.
Where are you about the Quentin Tarantino phenomenon?
Well, I wish there were more to it. How can I put this? I mean, he does have a gift for dialogue that draws upon old movies. He's entertaining. But his real talent seems to be for shallow sadism. And I don't know what to make of that. You don't have any feeling when you see some of these movies except brief suspense. You don't really care about his people. They're not people. They're just tricks from old movies. I mean, he's not a bore, and he's not an Oliver Stone. I regard Oliver Stone as the Pitts. He's not that. I mean, he is a man of some talent, but I don't know where he's going to take that talent yet. I haven't seen Pulp Fiction as yet. I will as soon as I get the chance to. But I have seen movies made from his script, and I've seen Reservoir Dogs. And it's not a fully satisfying movie. I mean, we're not dealing with Jean Renoir or the young Bertolucci or even the young Scorsese. We're not dealing with the full sensibility. We're certainly not dealing with Robert Altman there.
I've been talking to Pauline Kael on the occasion of the publication of For Keeps, 30 Years at the Movies. A final question. How did you decide what to keep?
Well, I wanted the big movies in terms of ones that I thought showed the history of movies in the period, and I also wanted to leaven that with some silly stuff, so I've got some silly pans and some riffs on actors. But mainly it's the ones that I thought showed what had been going on in a great age of movies. I don't think enough people realize how great movies were in the 70s. How much they meant to people. Wherever you went, people were talking about movies, and it was great. I mean, they really had reactions to them. They felt strongly about them. They either hated them or they loved them, and they talked about why. And it was important to the whole culture. It was something very positive, even when the movies were counterculture movies and attacked what was going on. They generated some energy, and now I don't see that. Even in the action films, it's a false energy they generate.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. My guest has been Pauline Kael on the occasion of the publication of For Keeps from Dutton, 30 Years at the Movies. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.